Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Game podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Indeed. And joining us today are The Times' very own Bill Edgar and James Gearbrandt. Coming up, we'll look ahead to the return of the Champions League. But first, let's get stuck into a brilliant weekend of Premier League action and that shock at Carrow Road. The Manchester City boss Pep Guardiola refused to criticise any of his players despite defensive mistakes costing the champions a shock 3-2 defeat at Norwich. Man City looked unusually nervous at the back, with Nicolas Otamendi's mistake allowing Timu Pukki to make it 3-1 before City clawed a goal back, but that was too little, too late, and it was a first defeat of the season for Manchester City. Now, looking at their defence, this was just the sixth time in 80 games that John Stones partnered Otamendi, so... James, is it as simple as to say they are missing Aymeric Laporte?
Yes. It's strange, isn't it? Because if you look, remember back to the start of the 17-18 season, the 100-point season, Stones and Otamendi was the starting centre-back partnership for the first half of that season. And they were very, very good together. Generally, they were extremely good together. And obviously, since then, Laporte has come in. Last season, towards the end of last season, Vincent Kompany sort of moved above Stones in the pecking order, and Stones dropped down to being the fourth choice centre back. So they've played together very little, recently. Stones and Otamendi. I think those who know Stones and know Manchester City well, kind of say that he's a player whose confidence can really fluctuate, and he's not necessarily the most confident character. And I think Otamendi benefits from playing alongside, a slightly more commanding figure like Laporte or Kompany, and obviously not with, someone like Stones, who's had so little kind of first team action recently. Yes, I mean, they had a bit of a horror show, obviously, on Saturday. Obviously, they were very, very culpable for the third goal in particular, when they tried to play out from the back, and obviously Otamendi was robbed. However, I don't think it's just as simple as Manchester City missing Laporte. And one other absence that I would point to, although he's not injured, he's not unfit, but he's just fallen out of favour apparently, is Fernandinho. I felt Fernandinho was really missed for whatever reason, whether it's age or stylistic preference. He seems to, have fallen out of favour with Pep. He's only, he's only made one substitute appearance this season, I think, in the first five games. But I felt City really missed him. I felt they missed his defensive output in front of the back four, particularly, his cynical ability to commit fouls to stop a counter-attack. I know it's not necessarily the most flattering part of his game, but I think it's a really important one, and I felt City really missed that. The second goal, I think, that Norwich scored, prime example of something that maybe wouldn't have happened had Fernandinho been playing.
Mm. I think he could be playing quite soon, of course, as a centre back if Stones and Otamendi carry on as they are. But Guardiola has said that he's a backup, and since they've only got three senior centre backs, Laporte is injured. And they're just running into the Champions League campaign now. Then this is the time that you start rotating. So Fernandinho can expect a call or two soon. But Yeah, Stones and Otamendi, they have started, I think, 73 matches between them over the past two seasons. So they've, and during which Manchester City have been pretty much invincible. So there's not really been that much of a drop-off. Yeah, they're slightly more liable to make the odd mistake, and then they did make two or three really bad mistakes in one go, and Norwich punished them. You know, quite often you'll get away with it, but they just got punished this time. So I don't think it's necessarily so calamitous, the absence of Laporte, but it is a problem, not least because he's only got one senior backup at centre-back for some reason. For such a rich club, it's quite surprising.
Well, obviously with Vincent Kompany retiring, does it sort of baffle you, Gregor, that they didn't try and fill the hole that he's left?
I don't think that was an easy hole to fill, but it is surprising they didn't sign anyone. I mean, replacing Vincent Kompany was always going to be hard, not just because of his defensive attributes, but obviously because of what he offers as a kind of leader and a presence in that back line. And I think that's the other thing that was quite kind of noticeable. Match of the day too on Sunday, they showed that there's not much statistically between Otamendi and Laporte defensively. In fact, Otamendi was up there in terms of, I think it was blocks and tackles, but on the ball, Laporte was by far and away the most kind of productive and the best user of the ball, basically. And I think what that does is just even the knowledge that the players around them of that Stones and Otamendi have the potential to kind of lose the ball more often and make the odd mistake. I think it just kind of it can create an anxiety. And I think you look at that defensive pairing and there's just not much kind of presence. And I think there's something that's not that uncommon, in fact, in a lot of defences in the Premier League just now. We'll probably go on to talk about Arsenal and how shambolic they were. And they're the same. It's kind of, it's not all about the glaring errors. It's kind of, I think they just, they're not players, not necessarily players that you can be totally reliant upon. And that sort of, is a sort of cycle. It sort of creates anxiety. It's sort of, you know, if someone is really calm and oozes sort of consistency and calmness, then it infuses the rest of the players around them. But it works the other way as well.
Mm. Well, after the game, Guardiola joked that it was, "Congratulations, Liverpool, you are the champions. We are in September. What do you have to do?" He says, "We'll recover, train and come back." Well, Guardiola wasn't the only one to mention the title race with Kevin De Bruyne, perhaps more seriously reminding Liverpool of their lead at the top of the league last season, which of course Manchester City were able to surpass. So is it too early, James, to read into this result and make assumptions about the title race?
Well, I mean, it depends what you mean by make assumptions about the title race. I mean, I don't think the title race is over. I think, you know, this Manchester City team can definitely haul in a 5-point deficit. We are, you know, at an incredibly early stage of the season still, and I think you know, as good as Liverpool are, and I really do think Liverpool are an absolutely outstanding team, I think they will probably drop more than 5 points between now and the end of the season. But 5 points is a lot, given, you know, the kind of, it's a significant margin given the incredibly high standards that those two teams have set, you know, particularly over the last season. You know, yeah, I mean, it's a significant advantage that Liverpool have in the title race already. And I think I think most people, myself included, would probably have leaned towards Man City at the start of the season. I think now, given the advantage that Liverpool have, it's probably, you know, it's a lot closer to a sort of, I mean, I thought it was close between them anyway, but I think, you know, it's now much closer to a sort of 50-50 battle. And you know, maybe, you know, obviously Liverpool at the moment have, you know, a significant advantage.
I think James is right. I mean, you know, 5 points difference now compared with three seasons ago is much greater. So because of the, I mean, and if Liverpool were to get the same number of points overall as last season, then Man City have got 33 games left. And even if City were to win 27, draw 5-5 and lose one of those last 33, they still wouldn't win the title if Liverpool do the same. So I mean, there's very little margin for error. Mm. I mean, I would say that I don't think I don't think Liverpool have been better than Man City this season. Man City were very unlucky against Tottenham, and as well as Norwich played, it was a bit freakish. I mean, I watched the match through again this morning just to make sure. And there were, Man City had four times as many dangerous situations where the ball was bobbling around the penalty area. It was, you know, and any nine times out of ten they'd have won that game. So I don't really think there's too much to worry about aside from this little centre back issue. But even so, the 5-point gap is quite a bit to make up. And given how well Liverpool are playing, and Liverpool have got a good system where they're incredibly consistent, and it would be no surprise if they had no dip in form right through the season.
There has been so much attention on City's performance. So are we kind of forgetting to give credit to Norwich and what they did, Gregor?
I hope not. I mean, James wrote a great piece in the game today that was sort of talking about the fact that this is the sort of fruits of a lot of, you know, a couple of years' labour at least, which really started with Stuart Webber becoming director of football and employing Daniel Farke, and then just completely changing the whole ethos of the club and bringing, sort of committing to bringing through young talented players like Todd Cantwell and Jamal Lewis. And really spending hardly anything. I think they paid, what was it, $750,000 for Sam
yep,
Byron.
Exactly.
I think that was the biggest outlay in the summer. A few loan fees. So that's, you know, that's unheard of really for a Premier League team, never mind a promoted one. And they're just sticking to the way they go about it. And as James sort of alluded to in his piece, it's not something. I don't think people think, what did Norwich do to sort of upset the apple cart and to, you know, Man City never get beaten. So how have they gone about this? They just did what they always do, really. They had to soak up more pressure than normal, but they knocked the ball around at the back and tried to break the lines and be as composed as they could in possession, and they took their chances, and they obviously, one was from a well worked set piece, and it was a fantastic day for everyone involved at Carrow Road.
James, what I liked in your piece, as Gregor has mentioned in the game today, making reference to the minimal spending that Norwich made this summer, that you say they rummage in the bargain bins of English and European football for unwanted and undervalued talents whom they can upcycle. I like upcycling.
thank you. Yeah, I mean, that is very much their philosophy. I think inside, you know, if you talk to those inside the club, there's a real feeling that actually they, you know, they can't compete really with any of the other Premier League team, but actually they feel that there's not too much kind of value to be had in that sort of, you know, in the kind of, you know, sort of £10 million region in the transfer market. You know, £10 million, you know, doesn't necessarily get you a lot these days. And they, you know, they really believe that they can sort of make a virtue of necessity, and they feel that there are actually, there's value to be had right at the bottom of the transfer market, you know, in, you know, free signings, which of course Pukki was the most, you know, as many people have said, he was a free transfer from Brøndby, you know, at the start of last season. This summer they signed Josip Dermich, the Swiss international, also as a free transfer. You know, the, you know, Buendia at the start of last season cost, I think, 1.3 million from Getafe. Byron is a great example because he'd obviously had a bit of a torrid time at West Ham, and such that he'd been so devalued by his performances, or, you know, just the general kind of perception around him as a player, that he was obviously available for, you know, £750,000, which is absolutely tiny, tiny fee by the standards of modern football. But
I mean, he went on loan to Forest last season and injured his knee. So, you know, it's a whole year almost wasted for him as well. So that is kind of, that is value, yeah, but it's still looking sort of quite deep beneath the waterline, you know?
Absolutely. But Norwich kind of recognised that, you know, there was kind of, you know, there was a good player underneath it all who, you know, under Daniel Farke could be, you know, moulded into someone who could do a good job in that system. And he was, you know, I thought he was excellent on Saturday, and, you know, sort of mainly was able to keep, you know, Bernardo Silva and Raheem Sterling quiet. The whole kind of idea is that they can't buy these players at the top end, so they either have to, you know, find them at the bottom end of the transfer market or make their own. And obviously, you know, Todd Cantwell and Jamal Lewis, who both played on Saturday, both academy products. Adam Ida was on the bench, and he's another one that they have high hopes for. Farker came, he came from the Hennersweisweiler Academy, which is the big, very, very famous German coaching school that produced Joachim Löw and Julian Nagelsmann and, you know, all sorts of, you know, very, very famous German coaches. And I remember I went out there sort of a couple of years ago, and there I interviewed the guy who sort of runs the course there, a guy called Daniel Niatkowski, and he asked me about Daniel Farke. He said, how's Daniel Farke doing? And obviously at that point they weren't doing incredibly well. They were sort of mid-table in the championship, but since then, you know, they've been basically constantly on the up and up.
Yeah, I think after his first season in charge, not many expected him to still be at Carrow Road.
No.
But my goodness, credit to Norwich and the board for sticking with him, and now they are reaping the rewards. So it is a first defeat for Manchester City, but Liverpool continue their impressive start as they go 5 points clear after beating Newcastle 3-1 at Anfield. Sadio Mane scored twice as Liverpool came from behind to preserve their 100% start to the season. Now, despite starting on the bench against Newcastle, Roberto Firmino still received the Man of the Match award, and it was a superb second-half performance from the Brazilian. On Monday's podcast, we spoke about the alpha male in the dressing room at Anfield and how Mohamed Salah and Sadio Mane are perhaps jostling for that. But, Bill, is Firmino the most precious?
I don't know if he's the most precious of the three, but he's absolutely vital. He's a brilliant player, very understated player. Plays nominally centre forward, but drops back into central midfield, and he's fantastic at winning the ball, nicking it off an unsuspecting opponent, and linking play. He's amazing, and but by dropping back, it allows the two wide attackers to move inwards ahead of him to the penalty area, and there Mane and Salah are obviously brilliant finishers. So it all works well for Liverpool, and as a trio, yes, they're brilliant, and he's a vital part of that.
Well, Mane and Salah may well be fighting out for top scorer, but you've kind of mentioned the work that Firmino does. He's sort of the perfect man in the middle, James, who links that play up and just goes about it a lot more quieter than his other teammates, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, that style of centre forward that, you know, is able to kind of drop deep and, you know, link play and be very unselfish and sort of, you know, bring the wide players into play is not unique, but I think the extent of the brilliance with which Firmino does it is very unusual. And as Bill alluded to, he kind of just transforms the whole chemistry of the team. It just all works when he's playing. I mean, I know it's not a proper match, but just remembering back to the Super Cup final at the start of this season, you know, that first half, Liverpool were really dominated by Chelsea. Chelsea were completely superior in the first half, and Firmino came on at half time, and just, you know, everything changed. The whole Liverpool attack just clicked into gear. You know, Mane and Salah were able to take up much more advanced positions. He's just so integral to the way that front three and indeed the team as a whole works.
Matthew Syed used the word fulcrum in his column. I think that sums up perfectly sort of his intelligence and movement and the lovely little touches like that one for Salah yesterday. No one else does that. I mean, they all have their own unique sort of attributes, and that just they combine to such great effect, but he is the one that sort of makes the other two play better. I'm not sure that's quite the same of the others, but they can do things on their own that just sort of light up the stadium.
Clearly Firmino should be the alpha male then, shouldn't he? He does everything. But for the second game in a row, every member then of Liverpool's first choice front three directly contributed to goal. And with big tests at Napoli and Chelsea in the week ahead, there won't be many that can deal with their devastating form. Although, of course, Bill, the Italian side will be hoping they can replicate their 1-0 win from last season in Naples.
Yeah, and that game, not just a 1-0 win, they absolutely destroyed Liverpool. So Liverpool should, be very wary of that. Liverpool are looking very strong. As a whole, as a team, I put so much of that down to Jurgen Klopp. It's just a brilliant, relentless pressing style that is just very effective. It's becoming very trendy now in football. Teams are trying to copy it, but he's really. It took him a year and a half to work out how to. It should operate effectively, and now it's incessant. Now they just have to find a way of making it work in Europe and domestically, and try and win both trophies at once.
Is that their biggest challenge then? The fact that they might have the European exploits to contend with, as well as hoping to win the Premier League for such a long time, is that their biggest challenge? Sort of combining the two, Gregor.
Yeah, but it's been their challenge for a number of years, and it's the challenge of all the, well, of Manchester City primarily, but all the other teams in the top four or five. So this is where you kind of the bits of luck with injuries and whatnot. Last season they had a great run with injuries, and the only thing you can really see derailing them is if they were to get an injury to one of the key players, someone like Van Dijk at the back or one of the front three. But they look really ominously good.
Talking of ominous then, the Newcastle boss, Steve Bruce, said after that defeat that there is no weakness to them. So how on earth does the rest of the league go about taking them on if there is no weakness to them?
The midfield, if you had any qualms, maybe Fabinho. I know you kind of hardly notice it because it's such a brilliant team. Everybody links so well, but on an individual level, he does make quite a few mistakes, gives the ball away a bit, and sort of missed times, tackles a bit. I mean, he's still a very good player, but I mean, the midfield is a step down from the front three. Mm. It's not really enough to hold them back from challenging for the title, but I think if they did want to strengthen, then I think they still need to get a better centre midfielder.
And as we say, we've said in previous pods that they've been letting in a few more goals than they had last season, so they're not quite as sound defensively. But for the rest of the Premier League, as Steve Bruce sort of admitted, it's just a wave after wave of attack. And if you try and sit in for 90 minutes against Liverpool, we saw what Firmino did, just drift around, finds little pockets of space and moments of magic that can just split open any defence, really. So I'm not sure sitting in for 90 minutes against Liverpool is the answer, but I don't know what the answer is to beating them either.
I think the thing that's really ominous about Liverpool as well is that players really improve under Jurgen Klopp's management, and that's what's ominous, I think. You know, I don't think we've really seen the best of Naby Keita yet. And I think, you know, were he to, you know, really, really kick on this season and you know, play as well as he did in the Bundesliga, which I don't actually think he showed last season, I mean, then, you know, they could really be, you know, truly extremely formidable.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Now, in a crazy, pulsating game, Arsenal threw away a two-goal lead to give Quique Sanchez Flores a point at the start of his second stint as the Watford manager. So it seems to be the same old problems for Arsenal. They face 31 shots at their goal. That's the most they have ever faced in a Premier League fixture since the start of data collection in the division back in 2003-04. The Arsenal captain said that the Gunners were too scared as they let slip a two-goal lead. This is what Granit Xhaka said. No one wanted the ball in the end, so we're happy to take a point. Didn't show our game in the second half. We were too scared. Bill, how alarming is it to hear that? Because if that was my captain, I'd be devastated to hear him say that.
Yeah, it did look a bit like that. The first half was fairly even, but the second half, in the mind's eye, there's just three or four Watford players all charging through the centre circle and no Arsenal player in sight. It was just so one-sided. It was totally embarrassing for Arsenal. They had absolutely no control over it at all. You have to say Watford, it's obviously a false position that they're bottom of the table. I mean, they really are a very decent team. And it reminded me a bit of the FA Cup semi-final last season when they came from 2-0 down to against Wolves to win 3-2, and when they absolutely battered Wolves from kind of half time onwards. To do it against Arsenal was surprising. I mean, yeah, I guess they missed Lacazette. He's a very good, you know, he's out injured for a while now. You're looking for Ozil to make a difference, to put his, you know, make his mark on the game. Didn't really do that. As for the kind of the defensive midfield, they had Guendouzi and Xhaka alongside Ceballos, who's slightly more attacking. So none of them are really that that good at defending. I think they're better going forward. But then when Torreira came on, it didn't make much difference. So it really is kind of the game to destroy confidence, you think, for Arsenal. Where do they go from here? They're light years from the title. They're not going to finish in the top four.
You're already ruling them out then?
Playing like that. It was absolutely hopeless, yeah.
I think the situation Arsenal is worrying. I think you mentioned the shots on goal. I think in the first, they've actually faced more shots on goal than any team in Europe's top five leagues. They're 98th out of 98, which is damning. And I think what Xhaka said is quite interesting, because, you know, quite often Xhaka, you know, as someone who covers Arsenal, you know, quite often, Xhaka is always quite often the guy who will come out, you know, in the mix zone, and he'll front up and he'll say, you know, we weren't good enough. And I think, yes, it's kind of, you know, it's in one way it's kind of alarming to say we were scared, but I guess,
I think it's lost in translation a little bit. I think it just means we weren't brave enough.
Well, I don't know if it's that, but I think quite often, like when teams, you know, don't play well, it's very tempting to say, you know, oh, you know, we were scared, or, you know, we were complacent. The kind of the implication being that, you know, well, if we can sort that, we'll be fine. I think what's more worrying is that the system isn't working, and, you know, I'm not sure they actually know. I'm not sure Unai Emery knows what system gets the best out of the players at his disposal. And what Xhaka said that I thought was quite interesting, you know, we didn't show our game, but, you know, do Arsenal, you know, impose their game? You know, do Arsenal have a style of football that they impose on other teams? That has always been my argument with the kind of Unai Emery with his tenure so far. I don't believe that there's a real coherent style. Yes, you know, we know he likes to, you know, he's kind of a quite pragmatic manager. He'll change philosophies. He'll change formations between games, and that's absolutely fine. But I think, you know, modern football teams do still need a kind of coherent, overarching idea of how they play. And I don't know if Arsenal have that. I don't know, you know, I don't know what type of football Unai Emery wants Arsenal to play. I don't know what type of team they're trying to be. And for me, that's really concerning at this stage in his project.
See, that, I think there's a tendency in modern football for people to think that overarching philosophy and way of playing is somehow a substitute for having people can step up and actually just play consistently well.
Right.
They have There's so many players in that team that, that you look at and they're just not reliable. And their captain is one of them. Mm. And I know I think there is some of that has been lost in translation a little bit. I don't think he's saying we're a bunch of scaredy cats. Mm. I think he's saying we weren't brave enough. And he said we didn't. People didn't want the ball as much as now. That isn't brave enough. But I think, as I alluded to before, with the kind of pairing at Man City, and I think Everton are another club. There's not really anyone I look to and I think reliable, solid performer or leader. I don't think they really have anyone. Arsenal. We've discussed this before. I think it really says it all that Jack is captain, and you can be branded a Luddite for mentioning this these days. You think if you know talking about leadership as if it's not important in the modern game, and as I said, it's kind of even when you talk about captains in Manchester City, we're picking their own captains, and Arsenal have got five who can potentially be captains. All of this feeds into, I think, footballers. There's less and less people you look to as kind of leaders in the modern game, and Arsenal are certainly a club that you look that definitely applies to.
I think Arsenal do like to. They are in danger of going onto the back foot a lot, because you look at last season, they faced about 30 shots more than they had themselves, and they finished top five, you know, miles above the average. So it's a kind of, over a long period, it shows their style of play was to give up chances. But generally, what happens in that situation is opponents shoot from outside the box, so you know, small chance of a goal. And Arsenal chances are all on the break, and much clearer chances on average. So and Burnley have done this for years, you know. So so their style, they have a style in that they do kind of sit back, really, as those figures suggest. But I mean, yesterday against Watford, they were sitting back, and they just, you know, in the second half, and there was just no counterpunch at all. Mm. So that's when it really looks terrible.
One other thing I would say is that the goal kick rule is becoming more and more fascinating by the week. You know, teams are asking their players to do a lot of them are asking players to do something they're not comfortable with, clearly, and it's costing goals. So I think it'll be fascinating to see how that kind of whether that lasts and persists, whether they keep asking centre halves who really aren't particularly comfortable on the ball to get the ball on their own 6-yard line from the goalkeeper and start building attacks.
And those sort of mistakes that Socrates is misplaced pass and Otamendi getting losing the ball, they're becoming so common now that you know. Michael Keane for England a few days before gave the ball away. Mason Mount scored for Chelsea against Leicester and just took the ball off. Indeed, boom, the ball's in the net within a second.
Makes for a good fun. Good viewing, but
you know, certainly will.
These sort of incidents used to be kind of one every 3 or 4 months, but now it's just every weekend. You know.
So what about Watford then, with Kike Sanchez Flores now back in charge? He'll definitely be happy with that second half display, but will he have any issues with the fact that he did have, or his side had, 31 attempts on goal, yet they couldn't beat Arsenal? Could that be an issue, James, for him?
Yeah, I'm sure he'll think that they, you know, that they could and you know, maybe should have won the game. They obviously, you know, clearly had the balance of play. Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Bill said earlier, that I think Watford are in a slightly, we're in a slightly false position, I think, that, you know, they, you know, although I think there had been, you know, a bit of a downturn in performances under Javi Gracia, I don't think that they're quite as bad as their position in the table suggested. But they're, you know, they're a strange team. They're very, very cyclical. And you know, we've seen this, you know, over and over again, including in Kike Sanchez Flores' first spell. You know, the team is, you know, plays pretty well under, you know, a manager for a while, and then sort of, you know, there's kind of a gradual drop off, and then the change of manager and you know, things pick back up. They're just quite a cyclical team in that way. The club obviously don't have qualms about making those managerial changes, and you know, maybe the return of well, I mean, on the evidence of this performance, the return of Kike Sanchez Flores seems to already have had a bit of an effect.
The Rugby World Cup 2019 kicks off in Japan this week. The Times will be at every game, and The Ruck, our award-winning rugby podcast, will be covering the tournament in its unique style. Presented by World Cup winner and former England captain Lawrence Dallaglio, we'll bring you the latest news from Owen Slott, Stephen Jones and the rest of our writers on the ground as they experience the sights and sounds of the greatest tournament in world rugby. The first of two preview shows is available now. Just search for The Ruck on Spotify, Apple Podcasts or Acast. And don't forget to subscribe to never miss an episode. Tammy Abraham's first Premier League hat-trick inspired Chelsea to a 5-2 victory at Wolves to kickstart the Frank Lampard era. Now, all 11 league goals under Lampard have now come from English players aged 21 or under. And right now it is Abraham who is grabbing all the headlines. Does his hat-trick then finally cement him as the player to lead the line for Chelsea over Olivier Giroud, Gregor?
Certainly for the time being, yeah. I mean, I'll admit it, and I think I said at the start of the season, I saw Tammy Abraham play in the Championship, and there were times where he gave the ball away a lot, and he scored a lot of goals for Bristol City and Villa. But I wasn't convinced, really. But the second goal in particular, it was his hat-trick goal, sorry. His third goal in particular was something I hadn't seen from Tammy Abraham before, where he turned Cody and with a little kind of shuffle, and he was away at everything, you know. It's power, strength, lovely technique, and a clinical finish. And I thought, yeah, okay, you've got something a bit more than I thought. And I'm not too proud to say that, you know. So yeah, he's. I think people are getting quite excited, cause, you know, talking. You shouldn't look at Twitter too much, but they're talking about a curse of the number nine and whatnot. And him getting handed the number nine was a huge sort of statement in the summer anyway, and he's certainly gone from strength to strength, and I think he's got real potential to be a success this season for Chelsea. Yeah,
he has already played for the Three Lions twice, but only in friendlies, meaning he could actually still switch allegiances to Nigeria, for whom he qualifies through his father, something the player himself has actually refused to rule out. Abraham said, "I've heard the talk about being called up by Nigeria. When the time comes, the time comes. I've not really focused on that yet. I'm focusing on Chelsea and hopefully scoring goals and getting victories." But he says, "We never know. You can never say never. Whatever comes first, just really." Would this be a big miss for England, Bill, if he chooses to play for Nigeria?
Yeah, it would, yeah. He, at the moment, he's showing potential to be an England player, for, you know, a long-term England player. You can't be sure yet. But he's had a brilliant start, and as Gregor said, that goal where he just held off Cody brilliantly, you know, great strength, great skill, great finishing, all in one. That was a real eye-opener. So certainly if England should be trying to get him on the pitch for the next qualifier, so he's no longer eligible for Nigeria. I mean, the fact that he's saying never say never, I mean, I think that's just... I'm not sure how much you can read into that. That's really politically what you should be saying, because if you say, "Oh no, I definitely want to play for England," you know, the idea of playing for Nigeria, going on long trips every so often, and then it turns out you do play for Nigeria, it's just going to be thrown back in your face, and you know, and then we have a bad game, people are accusing you of not trying because you don't want to be playing. So you know, it's best to say that. And it's also good for your own career to say, I wouldn't. Maybe I'll play for England. Maybe I'll play for Nigeria, because Gareth Southgate will hear that and think, "Oh, I better."
It's a bit of a come and get me play.
I better
really.
Actually make sure he does play in the next competitive game, so that he's no longer eligible for anyone else.
So, James, do you think he'll be in Gareth Southgate's next squad, or should he be in Gareth Southgate's squad?
I think he's. Yeah, I think he's. You know, he's got to be very close. You know, on form anyway, leaving aside the whole kind of issue of his, you know, dual allegiances, potentially. He's one of the form strikers in the Premier League, and he also very clearly fits, you know, an ethos that Southgate is trying to develop, which is, you know, to bring through players from the you know, successful England youth teams. I mean, that's obviously, he obviously did call Tammy Abraham up, I think, for the friendlies against Germany and Brazil back in 2017. And so he's obviously done it once. He's obviously a player that he's aware of. Yeah, I mean, look, you know, wouldn't surprise me at all. And he's obviously, you know, he's a much younger player than, you know, some of the other backup centre forward options that Southgate has at the moment, like the likes of Callum Wilson, who's a very good player, but maybe doesn't have the kind of, you know, upside that Tammy Abraham has in terms of his development. England have, everyone often talks about, you know, missing out on Wilfried Zaha, which is a big miss for England. And you know, I think, you know, that will probably be a bit of a kind of cautionary tale. And yeah, I would imagine that there are probably discussions, you know, going on already about, you know, making sure that he doesn't slip through the net, because he's clearly an excellent player.
If he does get a call up, Gregor, this has to be a decision based on form rather than the potential, doesn't it, of Tammy Abraham? Because you don't want to call someone up who might only play one or two games and then never plays international football again, do you?
I'm not sure that would be Gareth Southgate's biggest worry just now.
I'm sure
I think
you'll
want to get him in a squad and get him on a pitch. I mean, the only thing is, you just never know. It's always down to the individual. I think it'd be amazing if he continues in even half of this vein of form. He doesn't get called up to the next squad. I'd be amazed. But you just never do know about, you know, what the allegiances are, and he's, you know, how kind of strongly he feels about his sort of parental heritage as well. So you just never know. And he has spoken kind of more gushingly about the prospect of playing for England. But until he's out on that pitch in a competitive game, then it won't really matter.
Let's reflect now on the championship, and it was quite an introduction, Gregor. The Cowleys, as they take up the reins at Huddersfield. You've written a piece in The Game today with the headline of Cowleys facing a huge task at hurting Huddersfield. It's not a good season for them so far.
No, solitary point so far. I think only Stoke are keeping them off the foot of the table. Another club who hired a sort of lower league up-and-coming manager, Nathan Jones. I was just really surprised by how bad Huddersfield were.
you were there, were you?
Yes, yeah, I was at the game. And I think, you think when a team's relegated from the Premier League, they must have kind of a good squad and they've got money behind them, they've got parachute payments, they should be challenging. But I saw no evidence whatsoever to suggest that that's the case. In fact, I would say that Sheffield Wednesday have by far the better squad, more talent in the ranks. Gary Monk was another new manager who took the helm there, so it was the battle of the new bosses. And they were fully deserving of their 2-0 win. And Sheffield Wednesday are a club who have spent really heavily in the last few years, came close on a couple of occasions, got to playoffs twice. And they've still got the kind of nucleus of a really good squad there. They just lost away a bit under Jos Lehukai, and then Steve Bruce obviously up and left for Newcastle. But I'd see no reason. I would definitely be more optimistic if I was a Sheffield Wednesday fan than Huddersfield. On Huddersfield's part, I think they just lost a lot of players from the squad that got them to the Premier League and kept them up in the first season. Aaron Moy is probably the biggest loss in the summer to Brighton on loan. And the Cowleys kind of, they speak, they're inspiring, you know, what they did at Lincoln, two promotions, that cup run, FA Cup run to the quarterfinals. It's all built on sort of building bonds and strong relationships with the players, with the staff, with supporters, and they transformed Lincoln. I just think that they won't be afforded the same amount of time to sort of build those relationships, and they're well aware of that. He said that after the game. I think they held half an hour meetings with all 28 members of their playing staff last week, in the first week in the job. They say it's all, first of all, it's about getting to know them as people, and then they'll start working for you and you can affect them. So it's all about the human sort of touch with them. I just think, like Nathan Jones, like Paul Hurst, who was another one who went to Ipswich last season, these guys, they don't come in with a reputation. Some of them won't even know who they were. They won't pay the attention to Lincoln City, unfortunately. So they have to get some results, or else the task becomes harder and harder and harder.
I suppose it's the work they do in training which will then get the results, because if the players aren't having it in training, they're not going to have it in a game.
Yeah, and they're by all regards. They are very sort of huge detail in their work on the training ground and stuff like that. But I just think that, you know, he said we've got to become more process driven rather than sort of results orientated, or something along those lines. And I kind of immediately thought, well, that's all fine and well, but you need to get these results soon, because, as I say, the crowd could get sort of a little more anxious. It was a bad place under Jan Seewert. I think he won once in 7 months since his appointment. He replaced David Wagner in January. I think they've won 3 in 52 games. So it's woeful, really woeful form. And a big job, yeah.
And what is the atmosphere like there?
The atmosphere was really good before the game. They were warmly welcomed. They're well thought of, and they spoke kind of in the way they do about connecting with a working class town and that kind of thing. Is, you know, they know what tunes to play. and they played them, and they soaked up the applause beforehand. But Sheffield Wednesday took the lead after 10 minutes, and they were 2-0 up with 20 minutes to go, and it could have been more, and sort of realism came bit in the end, I think, for the support.
So it's not going well for Huddersfield, but it's different for another Yorkshire team. Top of the pile, Leeds.
Yeah, Leeds with a really important 2-0 win against Barnsley, another Yorkshire derby. Eddie Nketiah, the loanee from Arsenal. He's got 4 goals in 6 games, but he's not started in the league yet, and I think people are chomping at the bit to see him start and play more often. Because the thing with Leeds last season, they were the top of the Championship in just about every metric you could imagine, apart from kind of the ratio of chances to goals. And that's still the case this season. They create so many chances, and it takes so many chances before they actually hit the back of the net. Patrick Bamford is scoring. He's scored some goals, but he's not setting the world alight. So they really, I think they're pinning their hopes on him being a prolific striker for them this season, because they've got so much strength and depth, and people like Hildur Costa as well, who came from Wolves, he's still on the bench. Be looking to get him in the team soon. Luke Ayling still to come back. Almost a bit like Pep Guardiola. Bielsa's shifted Stuart Dallas into like an absolute world-beating right-back.
Brilliantly, isn't he? Yeah.
From a winger. So he'll do well to get back in the team. But there's a huge boost. Calvin Phillips signed a new 5-year deal last week. So yes, it's all looking really positive for Leeds. I'd say they're even perhaps performing better than they were, controlling games better than they were last season. It's just about converting those sort of chances into goals. And there's always going to be the lingering fear of kind of a Bielsa burnout. Mm-hmm. Even though it didn't really quite happen last season, it's just, you know, there's a lot of injuries and whatnot. It's just, that's always the lingering fear, but it's fascinating to watch.
Okay, something we will look out for, as we will with the Champions League, which returns this week. Tuesday night, Liverpool head to Italy, as we've mentioned. They take on Napoli, and Chelsea are at home to Valencia. And then on Wednesday, Tottenham are in Greece as they face Olympiakos. Manchester City are taking on Shakhtar Donetsk. Another standout game is PSG against Real Madrid. Which team do you think is best placed to win the Champions League this season, James?
Honestly, I think I don't think anyone is better placed than Liverpool or Man City. For me, I think they're the two. Still think they're the two best teams in Europe. We've spoken a lot about the kind of various, you know, rebuilding phases that a lot of the kind of traditional European powers are in. And yeah, I honestly think those two teams are better placed than any of Barcelona, Paris Saint-Germain, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich. But in Liverpool's case, obviously, it's obviously, as we spoke about, it's kind of managing the demands of European football with their desire to win the league, which, you know, I guess unusually is probably their, you know, is their preference or priority. They, you know, if you asked them, they would probably prefer to win the Premier League than to win the Champions League. And with Man City, it's the kind of, it's the hoodoo, it's the sort of, you know, the fact that they haven't won it. They've never managed to kind of get past, you know, whatever it is that kind of seems to afflict them in this competition. It's a little bit of the kind of, you know, we've spoken a little bit about how, you know, in recent seasons, Pep slightly overcomplicated. But yeah, honestly, I think those are the two best strongest teams. Mm. And obviously we're a long way off the kind of the stage where either of those sides are going to be found out. I mean, I'm fairly sure that both those teams are going to get through the group stage with no problem whatsoever.
Bill, do you agree? Those two, the front runners?
Yeah, I think they're the best two teams in Europe, yeah. Not so superior that it's inevitable they'll meet in the final, but yeah, I would certainly put those at the top. Also, I would think Chelsea and Tottenham will get through their groups as well. Over the last two seasons, English clubs have really re-established themselves really, I think, the strongest representatives among the big five, and basically the Champions League is the big five leagues now. It's not the 55 leagues. I mean, Real Madrid, it'll be interesting to see how Hazard and Bale get on eventually when they play in the same team eventually, because Hazard made his debut in the league at the weekend, and I think Bale was suspended, so when they get together they'll be worth watching. The Real still got quite an established set of players. They're not too old. I suppose Modric is getting on, but Kroos and Benzema and Casemiro are still, I think, reasonable ages. So they'll be a threat. And obviously Barcelona, Messi just never loses form, probably never will. So they'll be a threat as well. And I guess Juventus and Bayern Munich are the other two main contenders.
With Chelsea, they're facing Valencia, Lille and Ajax in their group. Gregor, we've obviously quite a lot on this podcast spoken about the young squad that Frank Lampard has. How do you think they're going to fare on the European stage?
I think it's like the Premier League. I think we said at the start, these guys are, we could probably know and say with fair certainty that they're Premier League standard players. It's whether they're elite Premier League standard players, whether they're capable of playing in a team of that'll get in the top four, maybe even win the league. And so far, so good, really. So this is another test. This is another sort of unknown, I think. And they're gonna come up against different, very different opposition, different sort of tactical approaches, and it's going to be a big learning curve for them. But I think all the signs so far are that certainly the three players that played at Wolves, Tomori and Mount and Abraham, they're good enough to play in a very good Chelsea team. One last thing on the Chelsea kids. It just does not make you wonder how many kids over the last decade or so there could have been. Mm. How many? There's nothing to suggest that these guys are any sort of more spectacular or talented than many of the players that Chelsea have been producing. They've been dominated. You know, I think they've won 7 out of the last 10 FA Youth Cups. This has been going on for a long time. Their academy has been fruitful for so long. And yeah, it's good to see these guys come through. It's great to see them play. And Chelsea fans are loving it. But how many have been sort of missed over the years? It's often hard. You've got staying at one level, at the top level, at a Premier League club like Chelsea. It makes you better. You're playing with better players and sort of testing yourself and push and stretching yourself. Sort of helps you grow as a player. When you have to drop down, it's often hard to get back to that level. So it's a little bit sad, I think.
Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Bill Edgar and James Gearbrandt.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. And we'll be back on Thursday looking back on a busy week of Champions League action.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.